Thank you. I suppose today I really ought to tell you something about Scientology. Well, I'll try to make this as comprehensible as possible. But Scientology is a science of living. And you can find all that defined in the textbooks. It really doesn't have any parallel science or activity. Because it itself happens to include those sciences of living which have existed in the past. That's quite embracing. Therefore, when somebody walks up to you and says, "What is Scientology?" you're on the spot right away. Best thing to do is say, "What are you?" The fellow says, "I'm a bookkeeper. It's a science of bookkeeping." But through the years, a great deal of technology has been developed. Dianetics was the first science, and it was left behind. It was left behind because it itself was not sufficiently embracing. A new thing was discovered. The awareness of awareness unit, the thing which a person is, the thing which does the looking at the mental image pictures, the thing which actually does motivate the body, was discovered about 1952 in such a way as to be very easily handled. And when this new factor introduced itself, we got a mental image picture of the original science, Dianetics. We used to run mental image pictures, which were quite damaging in many instances, out of the preclear. Then we started on a new tack. We started to run the preclear out of the mental image pictures. It's as simple as that. I mean, it actually is that type of a look. Very modernly, we used to erase, you might say, and desensitize the solids in a person's mind by releasing from them the phrases and other perceptions which were contained in mental image pictures. Now, not to be very incomprehensible about it, this is a very simple thing. Everybody has a time track, and this time track is very well timed, except in most cases. And a person has mental image pictures of all moments of his life, and these are either good or poor or otherwise, but he does take them, and he does have an impression of his environment, and it's quite startling to people to be run through a night's sleep and find out they were taking pictures all night long. It takes a long time, by the way, to erase a night's sleep. This is an experiment. And we find out there was some portion of the body conscious during the entire night. How's that for insomnia? Well, here we have then this thing we call a time track. The only reason we call it time track is the successive moments of experience which continue along with the life of the individual. Now, he himself is probably not moving in time, but time is moving around him. And as a result, he gets the illusion of yesterday and day before yesterday and 1,000 years ago or whatever it happens to be. Now, you understand that the theory of evolution has been with us for a very long time, about 10,000 years, written up very ably by Darwin about 100 years ago. And this theory of evolution has never really been seriously argued with. Certainly, the body developed one way or another. As long as we merely say the theory of evolution is the theory that the body developed, we don't get in any arguments at all. If we say it developed from lesser to greater forms, we might get into an argument. If we said it developed by natural selection only, we get into a terrible argument, because that throws aside any possibility of choice. Nobody ever chose what kind of a form he had. It was chosen for him by throwing dice. Actually, that becomes incredible to a mathematician. The actuarial possibility of all evolution in all forms having occurred by accident is so mathematically impossible, but it's too bad that Charles Darwin wasn't a better mathematician. he would have thrown this out. There's one chance in a figure which you start writing in small letters up there on that front wall and just continue across this way with zeros all the way over there and then the next line and the next line clear on down to the bottom that anyone would ever have developed an eye. As it is, you see, it's some fantastic figure. Because you take the number of variables in the eye itself, and you have an interesting thing. You know, there are eight muscles in the retina and the iris, and the complexities are... Well, the people who make Rolleiflex cameras just... They're just playing with mud pies compared to the complexities of an eye. And here we find this thing called an eye repeated every time we see a person. There's lots of people around. And so we add this other incredibility that it would be repeated twice in the same person. And now that two people would each have eyes of the same pattern and design. And we attribute this to accident? No, I'm afraid something else is at work. Now, we don't need to immediately go into the idea that there was some big Thetan who came along and mocked everybody up the same. We don't have to go into that theory. We don't have to enter anywhere into an argument on a religious line at all. Just let's look at it factually. You can see people around you. You know your person. And we discover that man has been en route for a long time. Now, the theory of evolution told us that he had developed from some kind of a cell in the sea or something of the sort. We don't know about this, but if this had occurred, then, with this idea of the time track, each successive moment of experience is recorded as a mental image picture, with this idea of a time track, we would expect, and indeed we would be dismayed if we did not, to find pictures of all of this in somebody's mind. And sure enough, you can take almost anybody and sit them down and say, go back 100,000 years and what you're looking at. And he'll tell you all sorts of things. But you can trace the evolutionary blueprint on this time track quite interestingly. That's a fascinating phenomenon. The evolutionary blueprint was right there on file, readily available. Anyone could have asked anybody to inspect it. It was a very easy task to develop a little electropsychometer that detected this even more easily than simply asking somebody. It read somebody's pictures for him, so you knew when he was telling the truth or when he was not. And just by the charges on the picture. And it was a very simple thing then to trace back the evolutionary steps of these bodies. And we did have this tremendous pattern, tremendous pattern. And if all this experience is summated on a time track, well, then wouldn't it also be true that all the accidents would be on a time track, too? Now, here we get into one of these odd things. How is it that a body records its own death? But I'm talking to you scientifically now, not in any other way. And I can tell you that if you go and investigate somebody's time track, just about the first thing you will find is one of the body's deaths. We don't say that's the person's death, you see, but we do find records of death on this track, which gives us an interesting piece of scientific phenomenon. Now, remember, we're dealing here with scientific phenomena in that it is observable, and when it is observed by different observers, they all find the same thing, and when they inspect it and weigh it in the final analysis, they all more or less come to the same conclusions, that it's there. Now, we have then this tremendous thing, a human mind, which has the ability to correlate these experiences. And like some, but much more expertly than, some huge electronic brain, it can take these things and shuffle them and give you answers, related, associated experiences. Fellow sits down to dinner, his wife has put on the table a green tablecloth. He doesn't enjoy his meal. The mind very happily says, last time you sat down green tablecloth, body, they fed you arsenic. And the mind is very, very handy that way. It hands up all these related experiences, one right after the other, and without further analysis, they go into effect on the body. There is no real analysis going on here. It just happens. It is a stimulus-response mechanism. Now, we are looking there at the stimulus-response mechanisms which were guessed at by psychology. They guessed these things exist. We had a fellow by the name of Pavlov punching dogs around, filling them full of stim to get response. And we had various mechanisms of this character. And all those people were studying, let me be very, very sharp about this, all those people were studying was the mind, a stimulus-response machine composed of mental image pictures capable of association. A person could re-experience by way of the mind the mental image pictures and so could re-experience the past. The entire thing is simply a mechanism of overcoming time. That is all the mind is. It's a mechanism for overcoming time. It keeps you from losing yesterday. You still have a picture of yesterday. In the last hour, you have lost an hour's worth. You've lost an hour's worth of walls, conversation, people, so on, haven't you? Now, that is a pessimistic look. And the mind is therefore pessimistic. Look at the optimistic look. In the next hour, look at all the pictures and experience and walls and things you're going to have. See? Look at all these things you're going to have. But the mind skids. And it has a very pessimistic view, ordinarily. So it never stores up pictures of the future. It only gives you pictures of the past. And the common denominator of the most effective, you might say, or upsetting pictures contained in the mind is loss. Loss, that is the common denominator to the pictures that really stick. Although the person might not recognize at once that he was really dealing with pictures of loss, after you'd handle it for a little while, he'd say, well, that's why I have this picture of the backyard. That's where I lost that nice cat. Up to that time, he's just had a picture of the backyard. Until he realizes that he lost a cat there, why, he doesn't change his position either. That's as close as he could come to having a cat yesterday, a picture of his backyard. See, he didn't lose the backyard. He lost the cat. And when the cat disappeared, he grabbed what? Anything that was there, a backyard. He took a photograph of it. He said, well, at least I had a backyard. Now, because he found out the cat was lost after the cat was gone, he didn't take a final picture of the cat. So we don't have a stuck picture of the cat, we have a stuck picture of the backyard. It's just as elementary as this. Now, what processes are there which handle rather competently this whole problem of the mind? You see, we're faced here with the entity of the body, and the body can be influenced by these mental image pictures in the mind. And we have here a problem, because these old moments of loss will become, as we say, re-stimulated, and they stick in present time. All right, now let's say somebody fell downstairs, and as he fell downstairs, he had a sensation that he was about to lose his body, so he took all the pictures he could. He took the pictures, and having these pictures now, he also has a picture of an injured leg, which he injured falling downstairs. He goes hobbling around for 3 or 4 days, waiting for his leg to get well. Now, the old Dianeticist, or the modern Scientologist, could produce a little miracle here. If this person were not in too foul a condition, he could take him back to the moment when he started to fall down the stairs, and he could erase the mental image picture, including the injury to the leg. And the moment of unconsciousness, which occurred during the moment of injury, would all of a sudden open up, and an unknownness would become known. Exactly how he did come to fall, exactly how the impact was received, these things become known, and the mental image picture folds up and goes away. And it's rather startling for somebody to see a person who has been injured and has been run on a Dianetic assist a little while after the accident, because people just don't believe it. Fellow had a burn. His burned hand was all burned, and it was blistering and so forth, and he got an assist, and he has a mild burn at the end of the assist. So what is the effect of this mental image picture? It's a fantastic thing that the past has more validity than the present. Now, the fellow still has a hand, but he doesn't credit this. His attention has been fixated on a burned hand. And so he has a burned hand. And as long as he has the picture of the accident itself, his hand will continue to be burned. Gradually, the picture will disappear and go away. And as that occurs, we get the phenomenon known as healing. That is what healing is, the disappearance of the experience. Now, you can catalyze that with Dianetics. And Dianetics consisted of a series of processes which made it possible to desensitize these mental image pictures. Now, naturally, an individual who has been terribly injured is not going to get well at all to the end of that particular life. The engram is going to be so bad that he's just never free of it unless it's erased. Now, that gives us then, in essence, the early fundamentals, the foundation blocks with which we work in Scientology. Today, a Scientologist never erases an engram, does this very seldom. Why? Well, we used to take the significance out of the pictures. That was Dianetics. Scientology came along and found what was looking at the pictures. And it's not then properly a study of the mind at all. It's a study of what looks at the pictures. Now, Scientology has all the technology about the pictures, but added to that, we have the technology of what's looking at the pictures. Naturally, if pictures have this much effect, and if they can be erased, there must be something around looking at them. Well, what is? Well, that's you. And you might say, who are you? Well, you. It's very simple. Who else are you? Are you Joe or Bill or Mary? No, you're just you. Now you dream up some identity and some characteristics, an eccentricity, and you take the mind and ask it to fulfill some of these conditions, and you have you a personality. Now we've added something. And now we're getting into you plus mental image pictures, you plus ideas, plus mental image pictures, plus a body, and we get a man. The funny part of it is the mind is more or less separable from the body. That is, say, a Dianeticist and a Scientologist can erase big chunks of the mind and supplant them. By the way, it doesn't give anybody amnesia. He comes into possession of more data, not less, by reason of having had some of these mental image pictures erased. They were hiding data. So it isn't a brainwashing process at all. You might say if the brain had anything to do with it at all, you would say this is quite the reverse of stimulus-response mechanisms, quite the reverse. It actually puts some information into the brain. The picture contained the information. You transferred it from the picture to the fellow's consciousness. All right. When we found that the mind could to such a large degree be erased, and we did find what was looking at the pictures, then the other question came along. How do you separate what is looking at the mind from the mind? And you get one of the top goals of Scientology. Mind you now, you can take a body. This is pure magic. I mean, if I were talking to a bunch of witch doctors down on the east coast of South Kenya or some of those other geographical places, and I was telling them about this, they would tell me that I was teaching them demonology. They would all be scared stiff and their hair would be standing on end. But it doesn't happen to be demonology at all. We have brought it out into the realm of one of the calmer sciences. Now, here we have, then, the body. Now, it's very easy to separate a body. Nobody. They bury it, cremate it, do whatever they want to do. How disappointing it is to discover that you only disposed of a body. The mind went that way, and the person running the whole show went that way. Now, the apparent action was, boom, body drops. That's that. Religion, other people, other fields came along and told you a lot of other things happened, and punishments and penalties and that sort of thing ensued. Maybe they do, I don't know. Last time I met myself coming back, though, nobody'd said a word about that. But that was the apparent scene. But even the most cold-blooded coroner is able to note the strange aspect of a body after it's been boomed. It is so quiet. It isn't wiggling a bit. There's nothing to wiggle it. And to a person who has seen many of these things, he begins to be able to tell at a glance the difference between some man who is lying very still and unconscious and is only wounded and a man who is dead. Now, they're both motionless. That's an interesting fact. But when you've seen lots of them, you can normally say, well, that fellow over there is unconscious. Pick him up and put him on a stretcher. There were 20 more lying around there, and you didn't even go near them. You knew they were dead. Well, what did the fellow have who went on the stretcher, which the body lying there didn't have? Well, the fellow who was lying on the stretcher and is going off, and we discovered was only unconscious, has his mind and his spirit. Thetan. I don't like that word, spirit. It's been used in too many ways. Good mathematical term like Thetan's very good. All right, so he's got these two items, plus his body. But the dead body became minus two things and actually decreases in weight. This is quite interesting. There are people come around and tell you these mental image pictures are a thought. And this stuff is the physical universe, and they're quite different. Oh, no, they're not. They both have mass, meaning, mobility. Same breed of cat, physical universe, can affect mental image pictures very rapidly. And I'm afraid that the mental image picture is the same kind of energy that goes pumping through any electrical conduit, but of perhaps different wavelengths. It's quite amusing to try to figure out what this stuff is. You get up into wavelengths like 0.2505 centimeters is the wavelength of an aesthetic or something like that. I mean, calculations carried out along this line do tell us this material is much lighter and much less susceptible to gravity and things like this, but it does have weight. There are various experiments carried out with that. Mental image pictures do have weight. Well, in spite of this, something carts them off. If you ask a dead man very, very quietly what he was looking at, he wouldn't say a word. Not because he's dead, because he hasn't got anything to look at. The mental image pictures are gone. We suppose that. There's no absolute proof of that. But the investigations carried on demonstrate that they are now elsewhere. The picture of his death went that way. I don't know exactly what it went looking for or why or exactly how it picks up into the genetic line again and makes another body, and these pictures are all repeated and so forth. That's a mystery you can have. I'm not interested. It isn't even important. But the Thetan, or the person that was running the show, doesn't ordinarily go that way with the mind. The mind is a sort of a machine. Its livingness is conditional upon other livingnesses. And it's as alive as you make it alive. A fellow who has a very active interchange of pictures is playing an interesting thing. He's playing a little interesting game on himself. He's changing the pictures. It's his livingness which is bringing life into his mental images. He is bringing life. The moment he doesn't do that, they become very quiet. They stop. Now, where does this spirit go? Why don't you tell me? Why don't you remember where you went? Why don't you remember what happened? What is this? Well, I can tell you why today. And this is news. I can tell you why you don't remember it. There is a level below apathy into which thetans go with considerable ease. Below apathy. It is below an emotional response. When you start to bring a thetan up the line with Scientology, something very peculiar happens. He goes into apathy. You say, well, it wasn't such a good technique. It drove me down into apathy. That kept us from using some of the best techniques I ever invented. It was a misobservation on my part. The person was way below apathy, and the technique brought him up to get him at least into apathy. And if it had gone on with its testing, it would have been discovered that the person would then have run up through the emotional band. Well, how good is a person's memory in apathy? You ever talk to an apathetic person? Is memory very good? It's pretty poor. All right. How good is the memory of an angry person? You ask somebody who's very angry what just happened, and he's not likely to give you a straight story at all. One has to be clear up there around boredom or enthusiasm on the emotional response scales in order to remember without the use of pictures. Well, why do pictures help him remember? Well, it's very interesting that pictures would help him remember, but they do. What does he need pictures for? Well, he needs pictures because he himself isn't remembering. Why isn't he remembering? Because his ideas of havingness, his ideas of possession, and his ideas of mass are all in difficulties. One becomes aware only at those times when one is in possession of mass. One becomes so dependent upon mass. One creates mass so seldom. One is working so continually with floors and walls that one becomes entirely dependent upon them being present for him to remember anything. It is the dependency upon mass and the dependency upon the picture which a thetan lazily develops, which then makes it difficult for him to remember where he's been, what he's doing. So therefore, conscious awareness in present time is a very easy thing for most people to achieve. If you give them more present time and more mass in present time, they then begin to understand more. What? Why? Well, they've gotten more mass. Now, the mass ratio to memory is an interesting thing. Dialectic materialism was so convinced of something on this order that it said that memory thought ideas were only present when two forces were in collision. And ideas came only from force. That is a lie. Ideas do not stem from force. But here's what does happen. An individual puts a chair down, and he says, "That's my chair." He has fixed the idea in the chair, you see. After that's his chair. But what's carrying the idea for him? Well, it's just like somebody who goes down to Middle Africa with a bunch of bearers and so forth, who are always carrying his dunnage for him, and he gets back home and he steps out into Waterloo Station here and says, "Where's the porter?" The porter comes over and says, "What you want?" He's carrying a little overnight bag that weighs about 1 pound. He doesn't conceive it possible to carry that over to the taxi cab. You got the idea? In other words, he's become dependent upon somebody else to carry that weight for him. Well, he puts the idea into it. How does he get that weight? He gets accustomed to weight itself carrying his ideas for him. Every time he looks at the chair, he doesn't say, "That's my chair." He expects the chair to tell him now Well, he told it, didn't he? Well, it should stay told. And thus, instead of carrying his own ideas and his own memories, he transfers his ideas into matter and then expects the matter at any given moment to give it back to him, like the fellow who makes notes. He makes notes, makes notes, makes notes. He never finds out anything that anybody is saying because what knows? The notebook. One fine day he's called on to use this information, only the notebook's home. You see how far that can go. All right. If we look over the field of memory, we find that memory has been consigned to one, mental image pictures, and two, actual physical objects. The function of memory is then, to a large degree, not retained by the thetan at all. He consigns it. And then he gets the illusion of being able to remember every time you give him some mass. So if you were to run in on him, speaking of Waterloo Station, if you were to run in on him, the bottle of Waterloo, you know, just hand him in its full mass, the Battle of Waterloo, he would then be able to tell you the name, rank, and serial number of all of his commanders, the enemy dispositions, how to load and fire a musket in 12 or 15 evolutions. You see, he'd be able to tell you all those things. If you did what? If you gave him the mass of the Battle of Waterloo. Oh, he'd go on by the hour. He just had the mass. He doesn't now have to have the action. He could say that's so-and-so ridge and that's the sunken road and so forth. My old pal Bates was killed over there. He'd tell you all about this. His old pal Bates, he hasn't thought about Bates for 150 years. Why hasn't he thought about Bates? Because he consigned his friendship for Bates to Bates. Bates disappeared. All he kept is a mental image picture, and then that disappeared too. How did it disappear? Well, it got too far back on the track. See, it's behind him. His immediacies are much more pressing than his yesterdays. And so what do we discover here? We discover that an individual confuses the possession of mass with the ability to remember. And to people who are having trouble with memory, the present environment gets thinner and thinner. You might ask yourself this interesting question. How wide is this present moment? How wide is this present moment? Is it 2 milliseconds into the past and 1 millisecond into the future? Or is it only 1 millisecond into the past and not into the future at all? How wide is it? Or is it 5 minutes ago and now? You see? We actually have a breadth of past when we look at the present. And your expectancy of memory is probably last month. And nobody expected you before Dianetics to remember childhood. Nobody showed you how you could, and so you said, well, a long time ago, I don't remember much about that. 8 years old and back, no memory. Very slight memory, maybe. 3 years old and back, that's impossible. The Dianeticist did the strange thing of being able to get a person to remember from birthright on up to about 3 years, and this startled everyone. It startled everyone. But the thetan who is doing this can become confused very easily. He can take another mass in somebody else's picture and call that his own. So he misowns these mental image pictures. He looks at the body's pictures that were never taken by him, and he says, well, according to these body pictures, I was knifed at the Battle of the Nile. According to these body pictures. Well, somebody was knifed at the Battle of the Nile. That's as far as we will go with him. Somebody was. He has a mental image picture, and the sensation is in the body of being knifed at the Battle of the Nile. All right, fine. We never contradict him and audit him. But the truth of the matter is that he probably never was at the Battle of the Nile. He probably was running some other body over that way. Maybe he was part of the Khedive's forces, you know. He's someplace else. It's very amusing in the United States to take northern and southern memories. They got all mixed up during the War of the Rebellion. Frankly, everybody that was related to anybody had relatives on the other side, you see. And you start running a fellow back down the track, and you run him back to 1862, and he says, "Ah, what do you know? Look at the woods." You say, "Yes, what about the woods?" "Well, there's cannonballs coming through the woods." "Oh, yes, and here's the fellows on either side of me, and they're in Butternut." "Oh, yes, I'm part of the Southern Forces." "That's fine, only don't run him back another 6 months. You'll pick up a picture of him standing up very bravely, standing guard mount at the White House or something, in blue." And he says, "What is this?" "Well, it's enough to make a Thetan abandon the whole thing." The positive sensation of being alive and of remembering is not eradicable. But an individual can get ideas of how he should remember and so eradicate his ability to do so temporarily. See, he can impose a system on top of a system. Let's take a very fine runner and let's teach him how to run by the Greek system. And having taught him very easily by the Greek system, then let's teach him much, much better by the Assyrian system. Entirely different systems of running. Well, now, if our boy is pretty good, he possibly would still be able to run. He'd have to be pretty good. Now, if you mix him up and you tell him the Assyrian system was really the Greek system, and you disorient him on his methodologies, he hits a confusion. And he doesn't like confusion, so he just skips the whole thing. And you come down one day and you ask him, "How about running?" "Running? What's that?" In other words, he becomes too involved in the significances of life. These become confused or interchanged. He is unable to be positive about his past because too many people are interested in having him otherwise or some such thing. And he then says, "Well, I'll just abandon that section." And he does so by postulate. Now, one of the ways of exteriorizing somebody is, of course, to shoot them dead. This is one of the ways of exteriorizing somebody. But it's not an advised process. Because it's really too easy today to run him on something like SCS until he is handling the body from outside. Now, what is this? What is this? Well, this is an easier method of salvation. I can get some recall myself on the ardors of being saved of a few centuries ago. It was rather difficult. Sackcloth and ashes, penitence and pennies. I had a hard time being saved. Not easy. Well, I don't know whether or not they were saving them from something peculiar or not otherwise. I'm not at all interested in this. We're not being religious here this Sunday. We're just being factual, completely factual. And they used to tie them up to stakes and burn them and do all sorts of odd things in order to save their souls in some fashion. And man got into an interesting expectancy. He expected that the next time he would find himself outside looking in as a Thetan, he'd be dead. And because it's so easy to exteriorize somebody by killing the body, we take any preclear we're going to have difficulty with, sitting down, telling him to be 3 feet back of his head, which he normally responds to with great ease. He begins to feel very sad. Why? He thinks he's dead. The last time he was out back without being dead was maybe 800 AD. You see? So he has become to depend upon death as an exteriorization mechanism. Do you see that? He depends on this. And therefore you have people who are trying to commit suicide. Why? So they can exteriorize. They know this is a positive method. Well, when this method folds up, of course, I imagine he'll have some dependency on something else. But the point is, that death became inextricable in the public mind of a century ago with dying and salvation. But the fellow who can't step 3 feet back of his head and look things over without adding all that brain around him is not in very good shape. So what, in essence, did this type of propaganda do? It made people stay in their heads and so forth long after, and many times when they shouldn't. Now, what do we have? What do we have, then? We have in Scientology today, whether we like it or not, we have it, the explanation of these various religious factors that man has been dealing with over a long period of time. We have his actual identity. We can practically work out a man's future from his own state of case. We can do various things that man has been trying to do for a very long time. But not being witch doctors, we merely use this in order to make people more able, which is probably dull of us, probably unimaginative, actually. If you know this much about people, you could undoubtedly cut them to ribbons and so forth. But we know you won't get away with that either, you see. That's also part of our technology. You cut just one too many people to ribbons, and you're cut to ribbons. We know that. Now, when we look over this vast panorama of information which we have, it's rather interesting that it could be boiled down in terms of how do you kick somebody out of his head in a rather brief statement, or how do you make somebody more able, or how do you make somebody remember better, or how do you make somebody more capable in handling his body, and so on. It can be made in a rather brief statement. I have given you briefly the outline of the problems which we have faced. Now, what are some of the solutions to this? You take it for granted that an individual who is not having too much trouble with mass can emerge from his body with good perception and look around. There are too many people who have done this now. I mean, it's been subjected to too many tests to be questionable. All right. Now, we can do that. In order to make it possible, then, what do we have to do? Supposing he can't do it, then what do we do? Well, you'll find that as you encounter difficulty in controlling things, you tend to approach them more closely. Let's take a shorter look. The fellow who is having trouble writing a letter pushes his nose closer to the paper. Therefore, as an individual has had difficulty in controlling his body, he has moved closer and closer and closer to it, and finally is in it, still trying to control it. All you have to do is rehearse him on the control of the body. What is the anatomy of control? Start, change, and stop. You have to teach him to stop his body and start and change it, that's all. And I mean, when I say change it, just change position. So what is this? This is the reason he went in was because he couldn't control it from afar, and the reason he comes out is because he can control it from afar. That's exteriorization today. Provided you don't upset the mass factor too much. Now, he has to be accustomed to mass, too, so there's something else you could do with this person, and that is to say, you could get him over looking at the wall and finding that it's solid. Every time he looks at the wall, he says, well, that's a solid wall. It told him. He didn't tell it. You've got to get him used to telling mass, mass. Now, what is the most significant thing he has ever told mass? What is the most significant thing that mass has ever told him? That it was solid. That is the common denominator of the statement. No further significance needed. And so, one of the modern processes is simply to have the individual look around and find things that he wouldn't mind making solid and just have him make them solid. Of course, he's liable to say, well, it is solid. No, it's not. That's something else. You make it solid. And the fellow runs out, you might say, a lot of his positioning of thought and so forth into mass. Now, how about this mind? Do you have to solve any part of that? Well, he gets stuck up against these pictures, and he gets into a a black ball occasionally, and other interesting things occur. But one of the things we do with a person today is to stretch him out in the old Dianetic position, you know. Pick out a center lifetime incident of some kind or another. Oh, when he was injured. Something, he's got an old mental image picture of a car accident, let us say, when he's 14 years of age. All right. We tell him to find a moment earlier than that. And when he does, we ascertain that it is not another engram. And when we do, we say, all right, make it solid. He does. We say, all right, now find a moment later than that accident. And he does. We ascertain that it's not another engram. And when we have done so, we don't let him make new engrams or new engram name for a painful image picture. And we don't let him make painful pictures solid because he'd get the somatic right back unless it discouraged him from making things solid. So we pick some innocent scenery and we have him make that solid and we go earlier and make that solid and later and make that solid. And just back and forth, you see. We never have him make the moment solid. We're giving him practice in making mental image pictures solid. And after a while, he overcomes the automatic function he has been performing for so long in making everything, letting everything tell him what it is. And he recovers then his memory, his computation on his life. And he recovers then his ability to remember without the assistance of solids. Why? Because we've run out his feeling of necessity for taking the message every solid gives him. And we give him this idea, and he's in pretty good shape then. Now, that's really all there is. In the most significant or effective of these processes. But these things can actually be put on a three-rung ladder. Communication, ARC, starts at the bottom and goes all the way to the top. In other words, any case could be run on communication. Any case, see, top to bottom. If you can't communicate with him, remember, he's dead. You can't communicate with him at all, why take his temperature? And you'll find out that it's probably room temperature. That means he's dead. I have to give you these little tips. Now, therefore, from top to bottom, in a processable range, he has varying levels of communication. Below 2.0 and on down south, all communication to him is solid. Nothing can communicate with him that is not solid. Everything that communicates with him has to be solid. If somebody handed him a written word, he would get it. If somebody spoke the word to him, he wouldn't. Solids. All right. We get above 2.0 and communication goes on up into agreements. Reality above 2.0 is not any longer solid. It is agreed upon. And we go up to 22.0, an arbitrary point on our chart of emotional tones, we get up to, he said it's real, so it's real. He said it was a communication, so it was a communication. You get the idea? That's really all there is to the upper ranges of communication. He postulates that he said it. Have you ever met anybody, by the way, that says that he said it, that didn't say it, and he got very mad because you said he didn't say it? Well, he's communicating by postulate, and sometimes it doesn't work, and he's sometimes minus 22.0. But here we have this interesting range. Then communication takes it all in. Now, there's a middle range of processes, and those are called the control processes, and they are simply start, change, and stop processes. That's the middle range. Now, they have a finite reach. They are very finite in their reach. They do not go as far south as communication, and they do not go anywhere near as far north as the preclear can go. But it's a necessary band of processes. Now, above that level of control, there's really only one thing that is keeping him from remembering everything and being able to do everything, and that is confusion. He feels that the things are too confused, and he wants them solid. You have to get him over needing everything solid. You have to get him to tolerate a confusion. So there is a confusion band right above that. Tolerance of confusion, which is also just tolerance of motion. People who are intolerant of motion can do very little because most doingness is motion. All right, and we get up above that, we run into another strata of processes, and these are creative processes. And old-time creative processing never worked better than it works today. You get where we're going here. You got communication goes the whole way, but it is the start, the bottom processes. Then we go into the control band, and then we're up here into handling confusions or motion. But remember, the controlling change isn't enough. We've got to get him into a band where he doesn't have to. So you might say your non-control band is up above that. Well, we call that the confusion band because those are the processes used there. And above this is totally creative processes. And above that, what? Well, the fellow postulates he's well and he's well. That's just change the mind processes. They belong way up at the top. Well, those are the racks and ranks of processes today. And whatever the auditing commands of them might be, just remember that a pre-clear runs on any technique that bites. And if he handles it with great ease and he doesn't change, go south, young man. Now, wherever we look, we discover that individuals who have not benefited under processing were actually not being reached in terms of communication by the auditor. I don't care how much he... I don't care how he looked. I don't care what he said back or anything of the sort. That just happens to be the case. We've checked them over. We find this is the case. What is communication to this person? Wow. I don't know. Cannonball hitting him in the middle of the head? Maybe that's communication to him. But we'll find some level that he can admit that communication is communication. When we do, we can talk to him, and his case achieves its entrance point and can then be processed upwards. The definition of modern processing is to discover, or that is the goal of it, the modus operandi of it, is to discover some capability which the person has or almost has. Discover a capability he has or almost has. Then improve it. Keep leading him, and don't let him ever get satisfied. That's all there is to modern processing, and that's, as far as that's concerned, this Sunday afternoon is all there is to salvation. Thank you very much.